You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the country is divided over stricter gun laws, but support for tightening background checks is overwhelming, according to many polls. What are the prospects for background check legislation in Congress? Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, there's a lot of information out there in the world, and using that info to make decisions can be difficult. That can be true if we're trying to find the best deal on a muffler, make an important medical choice, choose between political candidates, or decide on a guilty or innocent verdict in a courtroom. How do we decide which information is reliable evidence? And when there's evidence that points in different directions, how do we figure out which direction is the right one? Our next guest has been thinking about these questions a lot, and he says we could all learn a lot by thinking about evidence and what it is. That, in turn, could help make for better decision-making, better public policy-making, maybe even just better living overall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you evaluate information, evidence, when you come across it in a conversation, in a book, or online? What questions do you have about the meanings of evidence in the worlds of law versus, say, science, medicine, and public decision-making? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Frederick Schauer is the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. He's the author of several books, including Free Speech, A Philosophical Enquiry, and Profiles, Probabilities, and Stereotypes. His latest book is out today. It's called The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. Fred, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, delighted to talk about the book.
You're a law professor. I assume you've thought a lot about evidence in your life. What led you, though, to this project, looking at sort of the philosophy behind what is evidence and how we use it, not just in a courtroom?
So back some number of decades ago, when I was a practicing lawyer, I was a trial lawyer, so evidence was a big part of my life. And I've been teaching evidence for a good part of the 40 plus years that I've been an academic and a law professor. So in a sense, just like they say, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Because I teach evidence, I see evidence everywhere. But I think in particular, recent events regarding certainly politics and elections, certainly regarding vaccination for COVID, and a whole bunch of other things seem to have made evidence a little bit more front page news than it was before. And it seemed to me that it was time for me to think about evidence more broadly than just in the context of what lawyers use in trials. So that's what led me to the book. A little bit of it is about law, but most of it is not about law. It's about evidence in numerous different domains.
A big point that I took away is, I think sometimes we might think of evidence as sort of a 100% thing. Can we prove something completely conclusively or not? Most of life doesn't really work that way, and we have to think about sort of probabilities when we're setting our standards for evidence. How do we start to adopt that mindset?
Right. You're absolutely right. A running theme of the book is that evidence is probabilistic. Nothing is certainly true or certainly false. It's all about probabilities. And it seems to me that the question of how much probability is enough, how high should the probability be, is largely a question of what turns on it. There is a reason why in a criminal case, we require the prosecution to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, overwhelming probability of guilt before somebody goes to jail. On the other hand, in a normal civil case, one person's suing another for contract or automobile accident or whatever, we only require that one side prove their case by a preponderance of the evidence, slightly more than the opposite. So the big takeaway is that we can't know what the burden of proof is. We can't know how much probability we should require unless we know what turns on one answer rather than another.
When, and this is a common experience, when we see a claim of evidence that people say should motivate our behavior, say in a social media posting, do you have a quick sort of a heuristic, they might call it, a quick tool to evaluate that kind of thing?
Sure. Two things. One, ignore the adjectives. Very often we see people claiming that there's no conclusive evidence for something, no definitive evidence for something, no concrete evidence, no solid evidence. Ignore the adjectives. When somebody's using an adjective like this, they are trying to smuggle in the burden of proof that helps their side of the argument. So ignore the adjectives. And then the question is, why do I want to know? What turns on knowing? What are the consequences of knowing? And being alert to the fact that sometimes evidence that is far short of conclusive, evidence that's not even very good, might be good enough for some purposes. Compared to what is a crucial question.
We are talking about the new book, The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. Author Fred Schauer is with us, law professor at the University of Virginia. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on proof, on evidence, how you use it in your daily lives, how you evaluate claims. Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Now, you look at claims related to the 2020 election. That was one of the big, I think, political things you were referring to a few moments ago. And you quote a few responses to claims of widespread fraud. I want to listen to one that you cite in the book. This is Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, disputing President Trump's claims of voter fraud here in an interview with Savannah Guthrie at NBC's Today Show back in November of 2020.
This is the sort of thing you wish wouldn't happen, but is there any evidence that I'm aware of that there is significant large-scale fraud or malfeasance anywhere in Pennsylvania? Absolutely not.
Well, do you think more of your colleagues, you're a Republican, you're in the United States Senate, the president is suggesting with zero evidence that they are trying to steal the election with illegal votes. As you yourself just said, there is no evidence of that. Do you hope that more of your colleagues come forward and call out those kinds of statements?
My colleagues will make their own decisions.
So can you talk about, this is a big claim, widespread voter fraud enough to affect the election, with your approach to how we evaluate and understand evidence? What goes through your mind listening back to that?
So the first thing is that Senator Toomey is to be applauded for at least saying when somebody makes a claim, when somebody offers a conclusion, ask them what the evidence is for it. It's about politics. It's about everything else. Unfortunately, far too often we're interested in the conclusions and not the evidence in support of them. So the first thing is ask for the evidence, demand evidence, and then having done that, then evaluate the evidence in a way that anyone else would evaluate evidence, not just lawyers, doctors in deciding what diseases we have, scientists, anything else. But the basic idea is look for evidence before you're thinking about the conclusions. Far too often, public debate is about the conclusions. One of the reasons I wrote the book is a frustration with a battle of conclusions and no concern with evidence underlying it. So Senator Toomey and others in this context are to be applauded for trying to shift the discussion away from the conclusions and towards what's the support for those conclusions.
It's Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
I wonder if your guest has seen the documentary 2000 Mules, where they have the largest amount of data on the recent election. And proved fairly conclusively, if you look at it, that there were individuals that were tracked going to many, many ballot boxes and dropping off a large number of ballots at each one. There's testimony that they were paid to do that per ballot, and that the thousands of them in close races were more than enough to swing the election.
Jim, thanks for the call. Now, this is the Dinesh D'Souza movie that's making the rounds, Fred. Yeah. There have been a lot of people evaluating the evidence and finding a lot of the claims falling short. Is that something you've had your eye on?
Yes. So it's one of the things that we can learn from the law is that let's look at both sides. So I have not seen this particular documentary, but if this came up in a court of law, we'd want to hear the other side and give the other side just as much of a chance. So we'd also want to know if there are thousands compared to what. What's the percentage? What's the proportion? So I don't think anybody would deny that there are fraudulent things that take place in elections. What I'd really want to know is how often is it more in one direction rather than another? And what would the other side say about that? What's the opposing claim? If we listen to just one side and not the other, we're not taking evidence seriously. Indeed, the last chapter of the book is about a psychological phenomenon called motivated reasoning. It's very well documented that people look at evidence and evaluate it in light of what they want the evidence to show. We need to get over that.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Fred Schauer from the University of Virginia Law School, looking at his latest book out today. It's called The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. When you're looking to make a decision, looking to buy something, deciding who to vote for, you name it, where do you go for evidence? Where do you go for information that's going to swing your decision one way or another? How do you evaluate claims that you come across, say, on the internet? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with University of Virginia Law School professor Fred Schauer about his brand new book, The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Fred, before we go to our callers, I want to pick up on motivated reasoning you were talking about, which can work in a number of different ways, but you know, any sports fan will know that referees are just biased against their team, and we 100% know that close call should have been called in favor of our team. For watching a sports game, that's not such a big deal. But in more important circumstances, how can we check ourselves so we don't fall victim to interpreting evidence with that built-in bias, that motivated reasoning?
I mean, it's hard. The psychologists who've identified the phenomenon of motivated reasoning have also investigated the various different checks on it, the various different correctives. A lot of them just don't work. We see what we want to see. We evaluate evidence in light of what we want the evidence to show. The sports example is perhaps for many of us the most vivid one. Whether the ball was fair or foul, whether the receiver was inbounds or out of bounds, these are straight out factual conclusions. But we all know that the fans who want it to be one way, think that it really was one way, and vice versa. So the best corrective is just knowing about the phenomenon, knowing that it exists, trying to recognize that when we look at evidence, we are likely to be influenced by what we want the evidence to show. And that's the time to just count to 10 and say, am I doing this and why?
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Leo is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Leo.
Hey, I am a retired engineer, And I would like to bring up the basic scientific principle that correspondence is not evidence for causality. This is something that happens all the time, in particular in political ads where, oh, something terrible happened during a president's tenure, but that doesn't mean the president caused it. My favorite example is that I believe during the Obama administration, a comet hit Jupiter, but that doesn't mean that Obama caused it.
Leo, thanks a lot. And this, in our daily lives, Fred, if I had a bad cold and I drank some vodka gimlets, I got better in 5 days. Therefore, they worked. Well, of course, I might have gotten better in 5 days anyway. How do we sort out that correlation causality difference?
Again, in the scientific laboratory or in medical experimentation, we try to control for variables by isolating what did or did not cause something. Your caller's example or your examples are good ones. Again, the best we can do is recognize and at least understand what scientists do in order to deal with the phenomenon. That is, they try to say, let's control for a whole bunch of different variables. Let's see which ones actually make a difference. It's why a good medical experiment is, as it is called, placebo-controlled. If we think that some particular drug cured some particular ailment, the only we have correlation, but the only, or correspondence, as your caller put it, but the only way to find, really definitively find out whether there's causation is to give a substantial number of people a placebo, that is something that might look like a medicine but isn't really, and see if people with the same ailment get better anyway. In real life, we can't always do placebo-controlled experiments about real life, but we can learn from the scientists in just evaluating the evidence. Would this consequence have happened if this cause or alleged cause did not exist?
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Fred Schauer about his new book, The Proof, Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. Okay, you end your book on kind of a disturbing note, Fred. I'm going to quote your last sentence, if you don't mind a spoiler. For those for whom evidence does not matter, no amount of evidence and no amount of the analysis of evidence is going to make a difference. So a lot of us are concerned maybe about how we analyze evidence and use it. You're worried that a lot of people just don't. They don't care.
They don't care. And part of this is about motivated reasoning. Part of it, though, the optimistic, as you say, this is a pessimistic conclusion. The optimistic part of me would say, and maybe because I'm a professional educator and professional academic, maybe we can make some progress through education. I'm thinking back many decades to the history classes I had in middle school and high school. I learned a lot of facts. I learned a lot of history. I never learned one thing about how historians come to the conclusions about those facts. If we were in teaching history or in teaching anything else more concerned about evidence, maybe we would get people to be more alert to the problems of evidence and not just alert to whether they like the conclusion or not. So yes, maybe this is some motivated reasoning on my own part that I think that education might make a difference. But again, my high school experience was in that sense formative. I never learned about evidence in high school. I didn't even learn very much about evidence in college. You shouldn't have to wait until you get to law school, if you go to law school, to learn about evidence. It's not just about law.
So it sounds like you're hoping we think more, not just about what we know and what we encounter, but how we know what we know?
Exactly.
How can all of us aren't going to rush to law school to do this for the rest of us? Can you leave us with a minute or so of pointers on how to think in that way?
So I think the way to think in that way initially, like Senator Toomey, just to be alert to the fact that a conclusion follows from evidence, and what even if the conclusion is about a fact, ask what other facts we want to know to determine if that fact is true or false. So I've got a little bit in the book about art authentication. Once again, did Leonardo paint or did he not paint the painting called Salvador Mundi? There are facts that we could look at to determine the answer to that question. So look for more facts, look for the facts that lead up to the fact that we actually are ultimately concerned with. That's not very informative. Maybe it's not very useful, but that's what evidence really is about preliminary facts that lead to final facts. Look for the preliminary facts. Don't rush to the final facts.
We'll leave it there, Fred. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
We've been talking to Fred Schauer, the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia. We talked to them today about his latest book. It's out today. It's called The Proof: Uses of Evidence in Law, Politics, and Everything Else. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a Wisconsin veterans home is under review over concerns about the quality of care there. We'll hear from the reporters who broke the story. And check out a bonus installment of WPR's podcast, Mapped Out, and find out why a heavily gerrymandered election map may have gotten even more lopsided for the next 10 years. A reminder, we have an ongoing conversation going on right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We asked you today about your favorite games, board games, card games, you name it. Still time for you to share your answers over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And through the week, we'll share some more of your answers as we go along. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a criminology expert about the causes of increased gun violence in Milwaukee and other cities around the country and some possible solutions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take your calls about your favorite games, board games, card games, games with a group, or all on your own. We want to hear about them. That's coming up next. First, police crime data shows homicides and non-fatal shootings in Milwaukee are on the rise again this year after setting new records in 2020 and 2021. On May 13th, 21 people were injured in a series of shootings near the downtown Deer District, prompting calls for more action and investment in public safety. Here's Milwaukee Democratic State Senator LaTanya Johnson in a recent interview with PBS Wisconsin.
Every year this becomes a topic, especially for elected officials who represent Milwaukee. And we can never get help, never get help. But, you know, once it hits the Deer District, then it becomes an issue of concern during campaign time. And this is an issue of concern every single day for the people who live here.
Many communities around the country are dealing with gun violence issues similar to those in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How worried are you about gun violence in Wisconsin? What do you think, if anything, is making the problem worse? What solutions would you point to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Richard Rosenfeld is Curator's Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He's a fellow and past president of the American Society of Criminology. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
A lot of different factors can go into rising gun violence. What do you see as potential likely causes that we see in communities around the country?
Well, I think two come immediately to mind. One, of course, is the pandemic. Milwaukee, as well as most other cities in the United States, saw a large homicide increase in 2020, the first year of the pandemic. And Milwaukee continued to go up last year, as did other cities on average, although the rate of increase slowed somewhat last year. And through the first quarter of this year, with respect to homicide rates, homicide is basically flat, no increase over the first quarter of last year, but that's an average. In some cities, evidently Milwaukee, are seeing an uptick in the first quarter of this year. Other cities have not.
I've talked to gun researchers, fatality researchers in the past who said, you know, we have multiple different problems. One might be mass shootings, like sadly we saw last week. One might be gun suicides. When it comes to the kind of crimes that are driving these statistics we're talking about in cities, is there, I guess, a modal situation, a typical situation where an argument leads into gun violence? What are the specific factors involved in a lot of these shootings?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I would say the modal shooting situation has not changed, even though the rate of shootings has gone up over the last couple of years in Milwaukee and elsewhere. But the situation remains pretty much the same. The situation typically involves two young men, sometimes more, but basically two young men in an argument over any number of things. It could be an argument over money. If they're both involved in illegal activity, it could be an argument over the spoils from that activity. One dies in the encounter. That hasn't changed. That typical situation has remained pretty much the same over a long period of time. What has changed is the frequency of the fatalities that result from those situations.
Are there points where we could intervene, where we could find the people who are likely to be involved in these disputes that escalate in gun violence and, I don't know, turn them to another path of problem solving?
Yes, there are. There is a program that has been in existence now for several years. It goes under the title Focused Deterrence. And basically what it involves is identifying people at highest risk for becoming the next perpetrator or the next victim in an act of violence, and bringing those people into meetings with criminal justice officials, police, representatives of the prosecutor's office, judges, and with service providers. And often those meetings are also attended by family members of the individual and other members of their community, such as a local minister. And a two-pronged message is delivered at those meetings. One is, we obviously know who you are, and we'll do everything within our power to ensure that you're not the next victim or the next perpetrator. And if you are the next perpetrator, we'll do everything in our power to make sure that you're punished for the behavior. Secondly, the message is, if you want out of this life, here are services and supports that can help. And the choice is yours. Those meetings turn out to be very effective in reducing the level of gun violence in the areas where they're held. And in a few studies, I've conducted one of them, we find that the participants in those meetings go on to accumulate fewer arrests than a randomly selected group of participants or persons who did not participate in the meetings. So we have good evidence that that program is effective. It's relatively low cost. Those meetings can be held frequently. They can be held wherever in the city the problem of gun violence or other problems, we're focusing on gun violence today, where those problems are heavily concentrated. So the answer to your question is yes, there are points of intervention that do appear to be effective.
There are calls often when we see any violent crime numbers go up for more police funding or more police. I wanted to ask you, is there a best way to use a finite resources? Is it putting more patrol officers on streets? Is it more community policing? Is it more homicide detectives, or fill in the blank for me?
My answer is yes, yes, and yes. So the sheer number of officers, while not unimportant, is less significant than where and how those officers are deployed. If they are deployed in those areas of the city, and these can be relatively small areas where gun violence is heavily concentrated or where it has recently increased, elevating patrols in those areas, the research suggests, does tend to reduce gun violence. And by the way, without spreading it to other areas where the patrols have not been beefed up. Now, having said that, that approach has been criticized regardless of its effectiveness in reducing gun violence, it can often, the critics say, result in needless harassment of the young men in the community when there are more police officers around. And that obviously has to be avoided. And there's good research suggesting that it can be avoided. So this is an approach that does not necessarily have negative consequences for the communities in which it operates and can reduce gun violence.
We're talking about gun violence in Milwaukee and other communities with University of Missouri St. Louis criminology professor Rick Rosenfeld. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you want to see gun violence addressed in communities like Milwaukee? Do you think there needs to be more of a police presence? Does that mean more funding? What is your solution? What's your experience with this issue? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Rick Rosenfeld, Professor Emeritus of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri St. Louis, with us today looking at some of the causes and possible solutions for gun violence in large cities like Milwaukee, where over the last couple of years we saw the numbers unfortunately go up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your questions about gun violence? How would you like to see communities address the issue? How would you like to see police departments address the issue? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We got an email from Linda who writes, in my opinion, the most urgent plan of action would be to ban all assault type rifles across the board. That would be a start in the right direction. Rick, I know with targeted mass shootings, the ones with the high fatalities that we see in the news, those are often the weapons we're talking about. In our conversation now, that escalating violence, do we know what kind of firearms are most typically used?
There's a variety, but I think the important point, this goes to the issue raised by your listener, is that over time, the fraction of weapons used in crime on the streets involve automatic or semi-automatic type weapons with large capacity magazines, that fraction has gone up over time. And I do think that one of the reasons we're seeing more homicides, not just in the last couple of years, but going back some time, is the fact that these types of weapons, these more lethal weapons, are more frequently used. And that means the shooter can get off more rounds in a relatively short period of time. And the more rounds that are discharged, the more likely it is that someone will be hit or killed. So the lethality of the firearm and the use of these more lethal weapons is not an issue that's specific to mass shootings, though clearly a salient issue in that respect. But it's an issue that affects homicide rates generally.
I should ask about relationships between police departments and communities and cities, especially communities of color. We've just had the couple-year anniversary now of the death of George Floyd. How big a part of the story do you think that that lack of, I guess, trust between communities can be part of this story?
I think it's in a very, very important part of the story. There's reason to believe that the sharp increase we saw in homicides and other forms of gun violence in 2020 was connected to the widespread disaffection with the police after the George Floyd killing. In my own research, what I found is that in most cities, the homicide rate rose sharply, not at the beginning of the pandemic or even in the first month or two, but in the week following George Floyd's killing on May 25th, 2020. And that elevated rate persisted through the summer and into the early fall. So what was happening then? Widespread demonstrations across the country against police violence, police misconduct, greater calls for police accountability. And under those conditions, what in my business is called police legitimacy, the perceived fairness and effectiveness of the police diminishes, especially in those communities where police-related violence tends to be concentrated. And as fewer people have confidence in the police, they're less likely to engage with the police, less likely to cooperate in investigations, less likely to notify the police if they become aware of a crime being committed. And all of that puts upward pressure on crime rates. So police community relations has to be at the top of anybody's list of areas that really do require reform.
And briefly, just in our last minute or so, the ubiquity of guns, is there a sort of a game theory here where if I know my somebody I'm in an argument has a gun, they know I have a gun. Is that incentivizing being the first one to escalate to using a gun? Is that part of the story here?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. Yeah, absolutely. No matter who you ask, you can ask law-abiding people, or you can ask people who use guns in the commission of a crime, why did you purchase the gun? The overwhelming answer, no matter who you ask, is for my own protection while out on the streets or indeed in my home. And that, why do people purchase a gun? For their own protection, because of their perception that guns are out there. And if they don't have them, have a weapon of that sort, they could be on the losing end of an encounter. So the ubiquity of guns is self-generating, as you suggest, and it is a major problem.
We'll leave it there, Rick. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Richard Rosenfeld is Curator's Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. He's a fellow and past president of the American Society of Criminology. He joins us today to try to help us better understand gun violence in large cities around the country, including Milwaukee. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about finding a connection with nature.
Sometimes an experience touches us in ways we never would have imagined. Over a long Memorial Day weekend, writer Ron Weber witnessed a doe mourning the loss of her fawn, causing him to reflect on the similarities and connections between humans and nature.
Though sunny weather was forecast, my Memorial Day weekend plans did not include picnics or fishing. Yard chores and planting the garden was my fate. Pulling in the driveway Friday after work, I saw my neighbor had cut his first crop of hay. That aroma reminded me of the plethora of sights and smells that make this month of rebirth such a joy, and how much even we humans live with the rhythm of the seasons. Just after supper, as I walked towards the garden, I saw a deer in the field. With deer so plentiful, I never gave it a second look. Finishing my task an hour later, I saw the deer had not moved. Then I knew. Rising just after dawn, the deer was my first thought. I went to an upstairs window, hoping for an empty field. That hope was dashed when I saw a deer walking close to where I had seen it the evening before. I watched the doe walk through the field searching, until I couldn't watch anymore, so I distracted myself with breakfast. Working around the yard, I paused often to look in the field. Each time, there she was. Though often in the area I had first seen her, she also walked the perimeter and through the field searching, and I surmised, hoping. I was still hoping, too, when about 1 p.m., an eagle circled twice and glided to a landing 10 yards from the doe. It took a couple short hops and began feeding. The doe looked on as the eagle feasted. There was no denying my own sadness now. The eagle fed for a bit and took wing. The doe approached with her head low, and there she stood. As dark crept over the field, she was standing near where the eagle had fed. Call it instinct, dedication, love, whatever it was something to behold. A restless night of sleep followed. In the morning, I rose and headed for the window. I saw a large animal I thought at first glance was a wolf. Instead, it was a big coyote enjoying the spoils. The doe was standing 30 yards away. She sidled in until finally the coyote would have no more. It feigned a charge which sent the doe running. It returned to feed for another 5 minutes before racing towards the woods. The doe made her way back, and there she stood. That evening, I helped my wife prepare a new flower bed. Carrying weeds and sticks to the corner of our yard, through a gap in two spruce trees, I saw a deer 20 yards away in the field. Our eyes locked. I still recall what I saw in those eyes. It was sadness. Was it just the doe's or a reflection of mine as well? I'm not sure. I tossed my load under the spruce. The doe never moved. I dropped my eyes, turned, walked away, and never looked back. Darkness mercifully came. That evening, I realized I knew better what Alden Leopold meant when he wrote, "For one species to mourn the death of another is a new thing under the sun." I dozed off and slept like a rock. The next morning, the doe was gone. At noon, the farmer baled the hay. The curtain had fallen on this play. The stage was cleared and the actors left. In my memory, I would save the ticket stub from my weekend with the doe, in which I learned more not only about the nature of animals, but human nature as well.
Ron Weber is a writer and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up after the news, we want to hear from you. We're taking your calls on your favorite games, and you can get started right now at 800-642-1234. What's a game that you love to play? Do you have good memories of playing games with your friends, families, maybe solo games? You could call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also share your story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Looking to hear your favorite game memories, past and present, or what you're hoping to play maybe over the course of this summer. We'll take your calls coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.